All right, Luke 23 is where we want to begin in just a little bit. I will give you, if you've not been here the last week or two, a quick summation of what we've done. 2 weeks ago, we talked about blood. That, of course, is a big part of the Bible, and especially when you think about the crucifixion of Christ. If you were present last week, we talked about Jesus, some information about the crucifixion, as well as some information about the lashing, the flogging that he received prior to going to the cross. I didn't mention for you, in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 2 and 3, you have there some information which is interesting for a couple of reasons. Number one, that's the place where you read about the Jews. If you are going to be beaten by someone who is a Jew, that would be that you can't go past the 40 stripes. One other little detail that's in verses 2 and 3, you find in Deuteronomy 25 that the Jewish beating was not designed to degrade people. Sometimes when there's a punishment, it's designed to humiliate a person. And God made it clear that for the Jewish beatings, that was not the purpose. The purpose was to punish. The purpose was not to go ahead and make a person feel less as far as self-worth or degrade or humiliate that individual. It was strictly for punishment. I didn't mention, too, that when you deal with the whips, the Jewish whips, from what we can tell, were different than the Roman whips. The Jewish whips, they didn't have the pieces of bone, they didn't have the pieces of metal, because that, again, that wasn't designed. It was designed to punish, it wasn't designed to rip the flesh apart. But when you're dealing with the Romans, there was no limit as far as the number of lashes. They would strip the victim of the clothing, or at least take off the part of the clothing where they were going to beat the person, and the design was to go ahead and literally rip the flesh. So it was just in... What do we have?
Something.
Okay. All right, well, I'm not quite sure what that... Oh, piece of paper.
Sorry.
The design was to go ahead and literally rip the flesh, and it was very, very effective by the whips that they used. The Romans, from what I can tell, did have two types of whips. They had the kind of whip which was designed to rip the flesh. They also had another type of whip which was not really designed to rip the flesh. It was designed to be painful, and they used that for interrogation, or sometimes they used that to punish someone who was not going to the cross. So some variations between the Jews and the Gentiles, and with the Gentiles, the Romans, like I say, even some variations there. Luke chapter 23, let's start with verse 26. This begins a new paragraph in the ESV. And when they led him away, they laid hold upon one, Simon of Cyrene, coming from the country, and laid on him the cross to bear it after Jesus. Now, it's been a little while since we were in the life of Christ, about 6 months, so we're picking up where we left off before. And you may or may not remember that Pilate had made a number of attempts to release Jesus. Some have suggested that Pilate made at least five or so attempts. I don't know how many were made, but if you back up to verse 22, you find that at least three attempts were made on the part of Pilate. And he said unto them, the third time. So there were definitely at least three times when Pilate tried to free Jesus, but that didn't happen. The people refused to back down. And what was Pilate's problem? Did he lack power? No, he didn't lack power. What was the problem? He did lack...
Backbone.
All right, backbone, courage, whatever word you want to use. And he was just afraid of the people. So you have here him giving the authorization for the Lord to be led. That word is used at least 10 times in conjunction with Jesus' death, led away and to be put to death by crucifixion. One source said Pilate executed people without trial, and excessive use of capital punishment ultimately cost him office. From what Philo and especially Josephus show us of Pilate's character, any reticence, any reluctance to accept the local leader's recommendation would surely be more out of spite for them than out of concern for justice. So he was politically ambitious, and just like some of the, just like you see today, people are politically ambitious, but if bad news starts to circulate about them and their career, what do they start thinking? Bad news starts to surface. What do they start thinking? Well, either better behave, or what do we need to do with the bad news? We need to figure out some way to hush it up, cover it up, get rid of it. And Pilate was no fool. He was thinking along those same terms. This other quote, and then we'll talk about Simon a little bit more. One commentator claimed that once a criminal was condemned to be crucified, he was taken to the judgment hall and set in the middle of a hollow square of four Roman soldiers. His cross was then laid upon his shoulders. We expect something similar like that happened to Jesus. He was made to march by every road and street and lane and alley, while before him there marched another soldier bearing a placard with his crime inscribed upon it, so that he might be a terrible warning to anyone else who was contemplating such a crime. If during this procession someone wanted to come forward to claim the condemned was innocent, the judgment would be suspended and the case retired or retried rather, to determine whether or not the crucifixion was appropriate. Now, if that happened to Jesus, I don't know if it did or not. I would suspect that there would be some people who would really be hesitant to do that. Would you agree? I think so. Why? Yeah, once you have that kind of mob mentality, it's going to be tough, even if you really were a supporter of Jesus, to withstand that. What do we find with the disciples? They ran. So if you've got a non-disciple, a non-apostle, it certainly seems unlikely that they're going to try and stand up for Jesus. But like I say, this does seem to have been the practice where the people were paraded throughout the streets to encourage people not to do bad things, certainly not engage in criminal activity, and also to see if there was someone who wanted to go ahead and argue that the person was not guilty of the crime that they were accused of. Anything that you want to ask before we turn to Simon? Okay, thinking about Simon. We do have some information in other accounts. In Matthew's account, that would be Matthew 27 and verse 32. And in Mark's account, that would be Mark chapter 15 and verse 21. And here in Luke, obviously, we have Simon of Cyrene mentioned. John doesn't mention Simon. And John does say, though, in John 19 and verse 17, that Jesus did carry his own cross. Now, I'm going to let you think about that for a second. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all mention Simon. John, though, doesn't mention Simon. It simply says in John that Jesus carried his own cross. Any suggestion on why? John may have omitted that information, but specifically said Jesus carried his own cross. Well, we've talked on several occasions on Sunday nights as far as types. Things in the Old Testament pointed forward to the New. Can you think of anybody in the Old Testament that carried his own wood? Yeah, back there, I think it's in Genesis chapter 22. And it may be that John is thinking back to Isaac. I don't know that for sure, but he might be thinking back to Isaac and seeing Jesus in that same way. Genesis chapter 22 and verse 6 is the passage which says that Isaac carried the wood that he was going to be sacrificed on. So there may be some other ideas there. Maybe that's not the right explanation, but at least that's one possibility. When you look at Cyrene, anybody know where that was? All right, the area of North Africa, that would have been a port city in that area. And a little more about him, Mark in 15 and verse 21 said that this man was the father of Alexander and Rufus. Rufus, sound familiar to you? It's a name we don't hear too often, but it's a name that you find over there in another book, New Testament book. Romans 16, as Paul is writing to a number of people in Romans 16 and verse 13, he talks about Rufus. So, if the Rufus is the same, and there's no way to tell that for sure, then that might suggest that perhaps Simon, and certainly this Rufus, became a Christian at some later point. So don't know that for sure, but at least that is a possibility. Anything that you might ever ask before we make a couple of the points, Stan?
Well, you made the point that John didn't mention Simon.
By name.
So why did the other three mention him? He was simply someone to take the cross. Reason did the Holy Spirit have for wanting us to know that this man had a name and where he was from?
Maybe because of the Romans reference, Romans 16:13, to indicate that at a later time, you know, who knows what his belief was about Jesus at the time, but because of circumstances, he carries the cross. Maybe he hangs around for a little while and, like the centurion, draws some new conclusions. And maybe that was just a tantalizing tidbit to say that this guy did become a Christian. So that would be the best answer that I can give off the top of my head. Okay, some other things. Luke, as we look at his account in 23 verse 26, it says people laid hold on Simon. Now, that's probably not the word that we are most familiar with. What's the other word? And we have this in the other accounts, Matthew 27:32, and also in Mark chapter 15 and verse 21. What did they do to Simon? They compelled him. So usually when we think about Simon, that's probably the first word that jumps to mind, but Luke's account says they laid hold on Simon. One source, and you see this reflected in the Sermon on the Mount as well, Jesus said, if you are, what? Compelled to go 1 mile, then go two. So there were people who could be compelled to do various things. One source said they could force civilians to carry official correspondence, and Roman military personnel could organize bands of unpaid laborers from the common people to construct roads, fortifications, and even public buildings. So when you think about the Romans, I mean, if they needed some free help, some free laborers, they just go out and get a guy and say, hey, you, and you. It's almost like the military. They come along and they say, you know, you're here, and we have the authority to pick you up and designate you, so you're going to come. Help with the building or do this, that, or the other thing. And do you think you'd say no? Nope. So you're going to be at the crucifixion site for at least a little while. Tim?
Well, they had, the Roman soldiers had authority to kill people right on the spot.
Yeah.
They didn't need to show a cause.
No.
I mean, there's instances where they threw children up in the air and caught them on their swords for fun.
Yeah.
And so they, if you had your marbles about you, you were quite afraid of those people.
Yeah. Nobody was going to bat an eye or think twice about, you know, killing you if you were unwilling. You know, who's going to care about another Jew? So you're right. If you had any sense at all, you would say, okay, what do you need done? And that was shocking by Jesus when he said, if they want you to go 1 mile, you double the distance and you go two. Is that it? Okay, some other things to think about. Jesus, he must have been in a weakened condition because of the flogging. We talked about that last week. And Matthew 27:32, in that cross reference, it says, as they came out. Now, I understand that to be as they are coming out the city of Jerusalem. So think about the picture that we gave earlier. You have this Roman soldier. From what we can tell, this was typical. Maybe it happened within Jesus, with Jesus' circumstance. Maybe not. But if it happened like it normally did, there's this soldier. He's going ahead. He's got the placard there, announces the crimes of Jesus. People are given the opportunity to, you know, stand up for him and say, we think he's innocent. That didn't happen. And they reach the point where they're now heading outside the city of Jerusalem. They've gone through the various streets, letting people see Jesus, reminding people this is not something that you want to do as far as being involved with bad behavior. And as they're heading out of the city, they compel Simon. As you look at Mark 15 and verse 21, the Bible says Simon was found and he was compelled to bear the Lord's cross. Now, as you think about that, they've gone through perhaps all the streets. Jesus is headed out. They find Simon and they compel him. That sounds like pretty amazing timing, doesn't it? Simon could have been going in a lot of different places, a lot of different times, but it sounds like they're coming out. Simon is right there. He's compelled. Right guy, right time. And then if that Romans 16:13 reference is accurate, at least one of his family members, maybe he and other family members, also become Christians. Very, very interesting that all that lines up in such a way where Jesus gets the help he needs. And then other events take place where presumably he and some other family members become Christians at a later time. If all that worked out in that way, and I think that it's at least possible, if not probable, that's true, you have a great example of God's providence. You also have something which sounds a little similar to Acts chapter 8, doesn't it? You've got the guy who goes up to meet the chariot. Philip, what's the guy reading? He's reading from Isaiah. And Philip asks, do you understand what you're reading? And the guy says, how can I except someone guides me? And from that scripture, what did he do? He preached unto him Jesus. How interesting that everything lined up. He's at the right passage at the right time. The preacher shows up and he's able to begin right there and have the appropriate Bible study with this guy. So when we think about God, how his timing works, it is really, really amazing. Only Luke recorded how Simon bore the cross after Jesus. That's also interesting to me. You might think that he would have gone before Jesus, but he doesn't do that. He goes after Jesus. Again, why he did that, that's not stated. There are some traditions, which I don't think are true, but there are some traditions that say that Simon had a different skin color and he was exploited by the Romans for that reason. I don't see any evidence of that. There's no evidence that I can find that the Romans had any kind of prejudicial feelings towards skin color. So some of that stuff just seems to be items that people came up with over time. What we do know, I think, is that Simon was probably a Jew who was either in Jerusalem or had come to that city because of the Passover. And he probably had some brethren there. When you go back and you look in Acts chapter 6, we were there a few Sundays ago. Acts chapter 6 and verse 9, it talked about a synagogue for the Cyrenians. So there were some people from Cyrene who were there. Now, if you are Simon, you've come. Go ahead.
Going back to Philip a minute. Didn't the Lord tell Philip to go?
Yes.
I mean, it wasn't like he was just in that area and saw him.
Right.
God guided Philip to that area.
That's true. That is exactly right. And you would not want to dismiss the miraculous element there. But he does show up at exactly the right moment to get the guy right, you know, reading that particular passage. But yes, God did guide him. Yes, yes. So when we think about providence today, you would extract, you take out that miraculous aspect of it. But as far as the timing, that would still be true. So, very good. When we think about Simon, he's compelled, he's forced to carry the cross of Christ. What would that have done if you were a Jew that had come to Jerusalem for Passover? What was the one thing that the Jews wanted to avoid? Because that would not allow them to have the Passover. You are unclean, right? The Jews didn't want to be unclean. That was one of the things when the Jews were at Pilate's hall. They didn't want to go inside where Pilate was. Inside the Gentiles' area, that would have made him unclean. So, kind of interesting that Simon would have been made unclean by this. But if he did become a Christian, family members became a Christian, Romans chapter 16, surely that was something that he looked back on and said, well, I really was blessed that day. One other quick point, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask before we look at Luke 23, 27 to 30. You have Simon being pressed into service by the Romans. Do you think the Romans wanted to help out Jesus? That's why they had Simon come along and help?
No.
Yeah. It would have allowed them to make better use of their time to get things going. There was no compassion here. There was no desire to really help Jesus so that it would have been easier for him. Again, anything that you want to discuss before we look at verses 27 to 30, Luke 23?
There's probably two or three different reasons they pressed Simon into that. One could be he might have been a big fellow who looked like he could handle it pretty well.
That's possible.
He might have been seen at several different places where Jesus' disciples had been seen and was recognized that way. You know, it could be any one or maybe more than one of those reasons.
Yeah. Size is certainly one of the things that would stick out to me. You know, if you're carrying, you know, you've got maybe 70 pounds as far as that crossbar. You know, if a guy's maybe 100, 110 pounds, he might be able to handle it. But if you've got another guy who's 220, 6'2", he would, I think in the estimation of most people, be able to grab that, hold that, and take that to the place where you need to go without any difficulties. Especially if you're after the procession, you might need to hold on to that a little bit longer than somebody else. So, some good thoughts there. Brian?
I heard a reconciliation of Luke and John from the standpoint that John said Jesus bore his cross, that Jesus carried it all away. But at some point, Simon was compelled to bear it after him. So Jesus had the front, Simon had the back of the cross. They were both carrying it, but Simon carried his cross after him, or behind him.
Okay, we are going to deal with that. I don't know if it's going to be next week, but it will be relatively soon. We'll not spend a whole class on that, but people talk about some of the, sometimes they claim that they're contradictions, especially in this part of the life of Christ, or they will at least say there's a conflict, how do you resolve that? And that would be one, where people would say, okay, Jesus carried the cross, John's account, Simon is involved with carrying the cross, the other accounts, how do you reconcile that? Well, here, it would be like anything else. Somebody says, I went to the store tonight. Well, they're not lying, they did go to the store. But if a child also went to the store with you, do you have to mention the child?
No.
I mean, there may be no reason to mention the child. So you might say, I went to the store tonight with my child, or you might just say, I've been to the store tonight. Both statements would be true. But you are trying to emphasize sometimes one thing above another, or maybe it's brevity. So, and I do think that's what we have here. Is that it?
Said that Jesus stumbled and fell briefly with the cross, the weight of the cross, because he'd already been carrying it for a while. And it said they laid the thing on Simon.
Okay,
it didn't say that he picked up the end of it. It said they laid that crossbar on him.
Okay, we've got that in some of our songs. I don't think we're going to find that in Scripture.
Okay. That's what I've heard, so.
Okay. I think that's very common. I think that's likely.
When he said after him, that could have meant after Jesus carried it.
That could be. But when we think about stumbling, again, that is something that is often in the minds of people because we've sung it or we've heard it so long. But as far as finding a specific statement about that in Scripture, we're not going to be able to locate that. But another good point to bring up. All right, let's take a look then at verses 27 to 30. And there followed him a great multitude of the people, and of the women who bewailed and lamented him. But Jesus, turning unto them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming in which they shall say, Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bear, and the breasts that never gave suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, Fall on us, and the hills cover us. So once again, you have Jesus, he's headed out the city. They compel Simon, and as he's being led to his death, how many people are there? A great multitude of people. So it's not like this is being done in secret. You have several people, large crowds, and then you have some women. And it's interesting to me that the apostles have fled, but now you have these women, they're following the Lord. The crowd is distraught, they're distressed over what's taking place. What do the women do? Two different statements are made about them. They, all right, they bewailed and they lamented. And Jesus is very mindful of that sympathy. I mean, you think about the flogging, the beating that we looked at last week, and yet he's still thinking about these ladies. And he's got great sympathy for these women. And as he thinks about that sympathy, he makes the point that it is misplaced. He said, rather than weep for me, rather than lament and bewail me, where should you be focused on? Think about yourselves. Think about your own families, your own kids, your own children. Verse 28. He said, a time is coming when Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. We've looked at that from Matthew chapter 24, verses 2 through 34. And when that time came, there would be some people, I think especially women, but you could probably put men in here as well. He said the women were going to be thankful, number one, that they were or barren. Yeah. Thank God that we never had a baby. That has to be pretty bad. But that's what Jesus said was coming as far as the destruction of Jerusalem. Stereos. You can see how that would be related to our English word sterile. And Jesus made a similar point in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 19. He is thinking about the city of Jerusalem, how it was going to suffer when Rome came against it about 40 years later. You could also look at Matthew chapter 24 and verse 21. Then he says, as far as the Jewish people, they would be looking for cover. They would be looking for safety and so forth. And, you know, that just wasn't come. That wasn't going to come because the people had repudiated their only hope, and that would be Jesus. So it would be an example where people, they want help. It's almost like today. You see some of the flooding. You see some of the other natural disasters. The fire that's going on in California right now. People are thinking, oh, it's not going to come here. It's not going to hit our house and so forth. Everything is going to be great. And the fire creeps closer and closer and closer. They think the firemen are going to knock it out. And pretty soon they're surrounded by fire. And what do? It's too late. So hopefully somebody shows up as far as a person on the fire department, maybe a helicopter comes and gets them out, but that's what was going to happen for these people. It was going to be too late. Now let's think about this, the mountains and the hills falling on us. I mean, that doesn't sound too good. Why do you think people would be saying that? Yeah, I think that would be a good way to describe it. There's more than one way to die, isn't there?
Yes.
Would you say that there are some ways that you would prefer not to die? What would some of those ways be?
Fire.
All right, a person says, I don't want to burn to death. Another person says, I don't want to.
Slow and painful.
All right, maybe that would be a medical condition, but there is a slow, painful death. Maybe die of dehydration in the desert. What else? I guess it depends how quickly it is, but you don't want to be run over by a car. But, you know, there are some ways where you just don't want to die. And yet, a person says, if I've got to die, how do I want to go? I want to go quick. I want to go easy. I don't want there to be any pain. Well, if the mountain falls on you or if the hill crashes on you, what do you think is going to happen?
Instantaneous.
It's probably going to be instantaneous. So, not that they were thinking about this necessarily literally, but when the Romans came against Jerusalem, the people of Jerusalem, and they began to set siege, and you see the burning, and you see the smells, and you see the crucifixions and so forth. You're looking at these people, and you begin to see the starvation. You're beginning to think, I don't want to die like that. I don't want to have this protracted death. So we would prefer, if we've got to die, we want something that's going to be quick, that's going to be easy, that's going to be somewhat painless. So,
don't they have earthquakes in that area?
I I mean, Jesus, in Matthew chapter 24, he talked about the signs as far as the destruction of Jerusalem. He did mention earthquakes there, so that would incline me to say yes, but I'm not familiar enough with it.
Even today, we hear about earthquakes.
Yeah.
In the Middle East, right? And maybe this is what they were, you know, they've seen it before and they saw how quick the destruction of Jerusalem was.
Well, don't we have in Matthew's account, I mean, that would certainly be in the supernatural category, I would think, but an earthquake?
The resurrection.
Yeah.
When Jesus died in the
Yeah, Matthew 27:51. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in two from top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks were rent or torn asunder. So again, I don't think that that would have been out of line for the people there. So my inclination to that would be yes, as far as the answer. Anybody else? Okay, let's go back and see what we've got in Luke 23, reading down through 33 or 31 through the first part of verse 33. 31 says, "For if they do these things in the green tree, what shall be done in the dry? And there were also two thieves, malefactors, led with him to be put to death." And when I'm going to read all 33, but we won't cover all of it. "And when they came unto the place which is called the Skull, there they crucified him, and the malefactors, one on the right hand and the other on the left." When you study the Bible, a lot of times as you're reading a verse, it's really helpful to see what goes before it or what goes after it. And if you don't do that, it can be really difficult to interpret, at least interpret properly some verses. And that's what you have in verse 31. He says, "For if they do these things in the green tree, what shall be done in the dry?" If you're reading that on your own without any kind of context, you might think, I have no idea what that means. But if you look at the context, it becomes, I think, pretty clear. Let's think about wood for a second. Some of us have campfires, or you burn wood. What kind of wood burns well, dry wood or green wood? Dry wood. If you have green wood, you go out there and you cut it off. Maybe you've got a nice big limb and you think, boy, this would make a great fire, but it's freshly cut from the tree. What's going to happen? It's not going to burn. I mean, you're going to have to really soak that in kerosene or something else to get that to ignite, and it's going to be very, very tough. All right, a couple things I think are going on here. Number one, as you think about Jesus, would you say that he was like a green tree or a dry tree? A green tree. What makes you say that?
Well, it's sort of like he's saying, if they can do this to me, the living tree, how much more are they going to do that to you, being the dead or the dry?
Okay. Very good. Can we add to that a little bit?
Sure.
We say Jesus is like the green tree. How?
Awesome.
Well, okay.
He's everlasting.
All right. What was he talking about in those preceding verses? Let's go back and look at that again. 28, "But Jesus turning unto them said, Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not who? For me, but cry for who? You. Cry for your kids. Why? 29, "For behold, the days are coming in which they shall say, Blessed are the barren, blessed are the wombs that never bear, blessed are the breasts that never gave suck." And then they're going to say what? "The mountains fall on us, the rocks crush us." Why? Because it's going to be like we're what kind of tree? We are like we're a dry tree. What does that mean? You've rejected me. You've spurned your only hope. And you have pursued sin. You're now going to put me on the cross. And you're going to continue to reject my people. And when 70 AD comes, what's going to happen? You're going to burn up like a pile of dry wood. You deserve it. But if you look at me and my life, and you want to see, does he have any sin? What am I like? I'm like green wood. There's nothing, nothing at all that would justify your crucifying me as now we're in the process of doing. So Jesus makes a very unusual statement, but as you look at the context, a very powerful statement as far as the contrast between his life and the life of the Jewish people. Anything you might add or ask on that? Okay. Let's look at a couple of the things. Jesus was not only led away to be crucified. Luke said that there were some people with him, and who were they? They were two malefactors. We usually don't use that word too often, but we'll define that in just a second. They were led with him to be put to death. Had anybody predicted that? Jesus was going to be put to death with a couple of malefactors. Let's go back to the Old Testament. Yeah, let's go back to Isaiah 53 and see what we have in the 12th verse. We often hear that read, oftentimes in conjunction with the Lord's table or some other period at worship, and it's a good chapter to read. It's a good chapter to understand. But here you actually have a fulfillment of prophecy. Isaiah 53, verse 12. Who has it and wants to read? Gary?
Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors.
Okay, Jesus was numbered with the transgressors. If you're looking at that without any additional information, you might think, well, what does that mean, numbered or counted? In this case, he is put on a cross with the transgressors. When you look at that word, which is translated malefactor, it's an adjective. It's limited to here, Luke chapter 23, verses 32 and 33, verse 39 as well, and then 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9. When you look at Matthew, that's Matthew 27 and verse 38, and also in Mark chapter 15 and verse 27, your translation probably won't say malefactor. Anybody recall what they are referred to as?
Thieves.
Thieves. Some translations might use the word robbers. So they were malefactors, they were criminals, but some specific information about them would be robbers and thieves. Now, taking that a step further, can you think of who they might have been associated with? Well, let's back up a little bit. Jesus, before Pilate, what's one of Pilate's slick tricks to not deal with Jesus? I've got this custom. We give up somebody. And Jesus said, Pilate said, who am I willing to give up? Do you want Jesus or do you want Barabbas? What was Barabbas? I mean, he was an insurrectionist, but do you remember anything else about him? John chapter 18 and verse 40. He was a robber. So I wonder, since these two guys were also thieves or robbers, if maybe they were partners of Barabbas. They might not have been nearly as bad, but I do find that interesting that Barabbas is the one that's on Pilate's mind. When they lead Jesus out, two guys go with him, and they also happen to be robbers. So maybe there was no connection, maybe there was, but at least that is a possibility. All right, Jesus and these two criminals are taken to the place which is called the skull. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. You have one robber, one thief crucified on the Lord's right, the other on the left. And when you look at heaven, it had determined when Jesus would die, how Jesus was going to die, where he was going to die, and with whom he was going to die. Next section that I want to talk about is where Jesus was crucified. But anything that you want to deal with before we look at that material? Okay. Well, where was Jesus crucified? After we get through this, and we will not look at this tonight, but we also want to talk about when Jesus was crucified. There are some people who have some really different ideas about that. Some in the church, mainly I would say outside the church, but there are some people who say that Jesus was crucified on Wednesday. There are some people who say that Jesus was crucified on Thursday. And then there are some people that I believe have the right view, and that is Jesus was crucified on Friday. But we'll not get that far tonight. All right, when you look at the details about where Jesus was crucified, those details are somewhat limited. But we do have a few passages here and there that give us some basic facts. Let's take a look at some passages. We'll start out with Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13 and verse 12. Who wants to get that one for us? All right, Elisa, thank you. Brian, if you'll get the second one for us, that'll be John chapter 19 and verse 20. John 19, verse 20. Let's take a look at Mark chapter 15 and verse 29. Mark 15, 29. All right, Carol. And then let's take a look at Mark chapter 15 and verse 40. All right, Dolores. And let's see. That'll be enough for now. Okay, let's go back to Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 12. Okay, Jesus suffered. He was crucified where? Outside the city gates. Now that lines up with what we've said already about Simon, doesn't it? Remember, we're talking about Simon. They go outside, and once they get outside, then they see Simon and they lay hold on him. They compel him at that point. So how far they went, we don't know. But it does seem from our next reference, it was not very far from the city of Jerusalem. And there may have been some reasons for that. John chapter 19 and verse 20.
And many of the Jews read this title,
for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city and was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin.
Okay, the place was near the city. Why might you want to have a place of crucifixion that was near the city? All right, and we're going to deal with that in a little bit more, a little more detail later. But visibility would be one thing. You know, 2 or 5 miles out, if this is supposed to be a deterrent for capital crimes, not so good. But you keep that near the city. So that's one reason. Why else? Near the city, why?
Maybe just logistics.
All right, you know, you're tying up people, and the shorter the distance, the better that is. So logistics would be another reason. There's still another reason I think that's important.
It was a hill.
All right.
It was high up.
All right. We'll talk about that more. But there's still another reason that's key. Why else? What had they done to Jesus? And what did they do to other people? And, you know, you've got the bone and you've got the chunks of metal in there, and you're being absolutely brutal. Some guys died from that. So if you beat somebody in that way, how far are they going to be able to go? Not very far. So if you want them to get to the crucifixion site, you're not having to carry them out in a litter or a stretcher or anything, and you want them to actually suffer on the cross for a little while, you need to make sure that you have a distance which is not going to be all that great. So it made sense for multiple reasons to be close to the city. All right, Mark chapter 15 and verse 29. Okay, the first part of that, those who were passing by. Again, think about what we have. This is near the city, and you have people on a road, they're passing by. So we don't know for sure that this was a main road, but it does sound that it was, you know, reasonably important artery for the city of Jerusalem. And once again, if you're going to use capital punishment as a deterrent, it is a reminder, especially to the people that are coming into the city, as you're in our city, don't do what? Don't do bad things. I've not seen it in many years, but Don might be able to recall it, and Stan might be able to recall it. But one of the things, when I was in the service, they had a huge sign on the fence, and it said that this is a military installation. If you come on this base, we're authorized to shoot you. Now, it said something a little different than that, but I mean, that was the basic. You remember those signs, Stan? Oh, yeah. So, I mean, once you saw those signs, they were kind of an off yellow or off white, and you had red letters. And I mean, when you come on the base, I mean, you see that, and it's kind of like, wow, you need to behave, and this is not a fence that you want to jump. So people have used that kind of thing to issue some very, very stern warnings. All right, then let's take a look at that same chapter, but now Mark chapter 15 and verse 40. Okay, now if you're going to see something from a distance, maybe not in every case, but generally what's that going to tell you about the elevation? All right, it's going to be up, it's going to be elevated some. So again, I can't say that with 100% certainty, but when you begin to piece the things together, it sounds like this was on a road not far from the city, and there was a hill that you could look and you could see what was taking place. So it would have been the perfect place to crucify people. And maybe that was an area where Jesus and the disciples had spent some time. Some think that it's not very far from where the Lord's tomb was. I think that's likely, John 19 and verse 41. It does seem that it was a well-known site, because in Luke 23 and verse 23, it says, the place of the skull. And if you knew this area fairly well, and you realized that Rome was crucifying some people, it probably would have been an area that would not have been too shocking. All right. One of the things that I think is kind of fascinating is that the site of the crucifixion didn't really seem to get a lot of attention until the 4th century. So it's almost like people knew where it was, and then century goes by, some more time goes by, and then all of a sudden people are thinking, hey, where was that site? So a lot of the fascination that we have with the crucifixion just wasn't there in the first century. I didn't mention this to you last week, but there's a quote from C.S. Lewis. It said, the cross didn't become art until everybody who had seen it died. Now, I like that quote because I think that's probably true. The cross didn't become art or decoration until everybody who had seen it had died. This was gruesome. This was grisly stuff. So I can understand sort of our fascination with it in our day and time. But the people way back then, I mean, this was despicable. This was really, really undesirable. Matthew, as you look at Matthew 27 and verse 33, Mark's account, that would be 15 and 22, and John's account, John 19 and verse 17, they use the Hebrew/Aramaic term Golgotha. You'll have different designations for the cross. Sometimes it's the place of the skull. Sometimes it is going to be Golgotha. Luke 23:33, he uses the Greek equivalent, which is Calvary. So somebody says, well, which was it? Was it Calvary or was it the place of the skull? Was it Golgotha? All of those would be places that describe the same area. We don't know why it was called the place of the skull, but there have been a number of explanations that have been sent forth. One fella, Jerome, 346 to 420, claimed this was a common area for execution and the skulls of many victims were present. I like that explanation, but again, he's about 300 years past the time that Jesus was crucified. So maybe he was right, maybe he wasn't. There's some other ideas that have been put forth. One source, aside from him, suggested that this was a place for executions and the skull was a fitting image for the deaths. Again, that's at least a possibility. There's a very old tradition which says Adam's skull was buried in this area. Now, again, I don't know that there's any evidence for that, but somebody liked that and threw that out. There's another common idea that this area resembled the shape of a skull, maybe round and bare as far as a hill. I think, to me, that makes more sense than some of the others, but you can't prove that as well. One source said nature herself had anticipated the dreadful tragedy. The very contour of the ground is like unto a skull. Again, I really like that, but there's no proof for it. I certainly wouldn't want to stake my life on that, but it's interesting that if that did happen, then that might help explain why it was the place of the skull. Some things that you want to add or ask over that or something else? Nobody? Okay, we're done for tonight.